I see a world, perhaps it's 5 years away, perhaps it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years away, because it really does depend on adoption and the open-mindedness of the industry as a whole to adopt technologies that make their life easier, that make things far more efficient and scalable, so that everyday activities that historically have been manual can be turned into tech-enabled and near-automated solutions.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Paul Wiltshire, music technology entrepreneur and CEO of SongTrader. SongTrader is the only open and automated licensing marketplace of its kind, with all types of music users from independent filmmakers, production houses, and advertising agencies to major brands like Google, Disney, Netflix, and Amazon. Since the platform's official global launch in 2016, it's rapidly grown to more than 400,000 artists, producers, and songwriters worldwide, using its technology for content management, distribution, and licensing. Paul's career began as an award-winning producer and songwriter, having produced or composed music on 12 number one and 28 top 20 albums and singles. You'll find out more about Paul's music production background on episode 106. During the interview, we talked about building music industry infrastructure, SongTrader's acquisition of Bandcamp, having a music supervisor team that works with brands, using AI to generate metadata, and much more. I spoke with Paul via Zoom from his office in Los Angeles. Let's start back with SongTrader. Since the last time we talked, what has changed with it?
Well, I think we talked in, must have been 2016 or 2017. So a lot has changed since then. The original vision for SongTrader was to make licensing simple and to create a marketplace which solved one of the key problems that the industry faces, which is fragmentation of rights. And one of the barriers to music licensing is that it's not always one owner that controls the recording and the copyright. And there's often multiple publishers sometimes there's co-writers that represent their own rights. Sometimes they have publishers. And the genesis of SongTrader was to create a platform where fragmented rights holders could come together and license their music as one. And that's where we began. And we found that the independent community was very supportive, independent artists and songwriters, and it was easier for them to adopt the platform. Since then, we focus very much on how do we drive more and more business into the licensing ecosystem. And we focused on several different layers. One particular layer was advertising. Music and advertising is a big business. The advertising industry is close on $1 trillion business. The music doesn't represent that, but it's a big part of it. And we used M&A to acquire some key businesses to really accelerate the number of customers we had buying music from us. And our music licensing business has since evolved to be something that includes composition, where we have a number of composers in our network that compose music for advertisers and brands, as well as licensing, hit tracks, helping match a commercially popular track, identifying the rights holders, the publishers, the labels, and matching that track to the right. The right campaign or advertising brief. That's sort of part one. Since we spoke, it's expanding the licensing business to be a global business. We're in many countries across the world. We have offices in Sydney, in Los Angeles, in New York. I chose Sydney first because I'm Australian.
Yeah, all right.
But it's not our biggest office. But we have offices in London, Amsterdam, Berlin, Tokyo, Singapore, all across the world. The second business unit, which is it's certainly one that's been picking up a lot of steam in the last few years and very relevant, I think, to the industry's future, is our technology side of the business, which, although our music licensing business is very much a tech, what I mean by our music technology division is how music can be served and used by a digital platform. And a digital platform can be anything from a social media network to a streaming platform to a game platform. And there are a number of problems to solve in that space. And we acquired a company called Seven Digital last year, which was a key asset for us because it acts as a distributor of content. It has the world's music that's delivered to Seven Digital, and it's delivers that music to large global platforms in order to really streamline delivery. But when we combine the Seven Digital technology products and the SongTrader products, we have a full suite of technologies that allow any platform to use our technology to serve music, to have a search so that you can discover music, to playlisting technology, to accounting and royalty payments. So think of it as kind of end-to-end solution and from a technology perspective. So if a new startup wanted to leverage music, it could use all of our technologies without having to build that architecture. The third business unit, which, and it all glues together neatly, and it might take a bit of time to unpack that, and we can probably do that today, is we acquired Bandcamp last year.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure all your listeners know what Bandcamp is.
Yeah, you bet.
Bandcamp is this incredible platform. It's the largest platform for artists and labels to sell their music products directly to their fans. And it's a really important piece to the music ecosystem, let alone our business, where it allows artists to be able to sell their music and really be paid fairly for it, and their music products, not just their music. And perhaps I'll pause there. So.
Well, I'm really curious in this grand strategy here. When you're acquiring a company, and there's what, seven of them that you acquired, six, seven, something like that?
I think we've done about 10 now, but you know.
10, okay. Well, was this like an opportunity that happened where you saw, for instance, Bandcamp might be for sale, or was this something that was in your long-term strategy? It's like, well, we need this, and then we need this, and then we need this.
So speaking generally to what we've done over the last, I guess it's been almost 10 years now, but we started using M&A to accelerate our growth in 2019. We did our first transaction, and the mentality is that we've built a core technology, and that technology benefits from other key technologies that would be, in many respects, would take too long a time to build everything that needs to be built for the industry. The way we see ourselves is we're building music industry infrastructure. So when we're not in the business of owning music IP in terms of being a library or a catalog to compete with other catalogs. It's very important for us to be agnostic and to really complement the entire industry in terms of the music supply. So we looked at a number of opportunities in terms of, we looked through the lens of customer acquisition. How do we speed up the marketplace by acquiring businesses that have customer base that could then generate more licensing activity? That was one key strategy that we applied with some of our M&A. And then the other piece was really very much technology-based. What key technologies are we missing that would allow us to get one step closer to being a platform that can be a single solution for other platforms to access music? And it doesn't necessarily just mean licensing. It can mean delivery of music and what I sort of touched on in our technology space. But there are a lot of problems to solve in the music industry. There's growing mismatch royalties. Although there's been steps taken, with the MLC and other aspects of the industry to solve a lot of the issues with royalty collection, the reality is the independent music business still has reasonably poor data standards, and that does equal a lot of missing income for that community. So there's a number of problems there. There are also barriers of entry to technologies who want to use music, but it's either too expensive to access it or too expensive to build the infrastructure and an architect, the ability to use it at scale. There's all kinds of barriers of entry for use of music. And I think that has an impact on the size of the industry too. So where we see ourselves really fitting in is being that infrastructure to kind of unlock future value of music, to expand the value of the music industry so it benefits all the music industry, and to really unlock the ability for it to be used at scale so that cheap alternatives, and we can talk about AI and the impact that, you know, that could have on devaluing the music industry, but so that those cheap alternatives are not a trap to fall into because access to music is so difficult.
Well, let's go there since you touched on it. AI and the music industry, I think everyone is very hyper aware of this, especially since the last couple weeks where there was this artist that generated a tremendous amount of AI-generated music that generated a lot of royalties for him. And then to find out that Boomi's CEO, the AI platform Boomi, the CEO was involved, his name is as a co-writer, that kind of taints the industry. Or that part of the industry anyway. So how do you see that?
I think we've got to be very careful to legislate, to do everything we can to impact the legislation that protects the interests of creators of music. I think there's many benefits to AI in the creative process, but when it can be abused for gaming the system, where it's not about the art, it's not about creativity, it's just a pure cash grab. That's sort of evidence of one aspect of the danger. So, I have very strong thoughts about if a machine is going to learn how to make the music, it has to do it from music where express permission has been granted. Now, no label, at least no major label in their right mind, would grant that, I think, for a third-party platform to make versions of its music without incredibly strong reasons to. I just can't imagine that happening. And we know that the labels are pushing hard against that, and they should. Where I think AI is very powerful is in the creative process. My background was a record producer going back a lifetime ago into the 90s and the early 2000s. And having a machine being able to help with the creative process, whether it's being able to create a bass part or a synthesizer part or any kind of sort of element to help unlock your creativity, I think is really powerful. I think it's really interesting in also learning or putting your stems into the machine to create new versions of your own track where the ownership remains constant and there is no exploitation of ownership because it's your music being recreated. I think there's endless sort of opportunities with AI to complement and unlock up-and-coming creators that may not have the skills to play a great guitar part, but they are a great musician and they know what's good. And there's always going to be that fine line that we dance where AI will inevitably unlock millions more artists to come and release music. But I think when that music is really just created by a machine, it's problematic. So where is the line? I don't have the answer. But I think the line has to be at least beginning with if the machine has learnt off music that it didn't have permission to learn from, it has to be legislated against. It has to be something that is resisted by the industry as much as it can.
Yeah, there's a lot of that now. I think you see a lot of the song creation AIs coming out that have forget what they call it, ethical. It's an ethical AI, as they would call it, meaning that it's learned off of music that was signed off on. But you have to wonder, that's going to be a much smaller database than, you know, the way it's been working up until now, where they scrape the whole internet. And, you know, the funny part about that is, too, even those large language models, AIs that do that, it's still not easy to actually create what you want. And I've gone down a rabbit hole with this, where you go down, you say, you know, write a song like Drake or whatever the case, and it will come up with something, but then it might not have a chorus. For certain, it won't have a bridge. There won't be a pre-chorus, and you have to keep on prompting, and it takes forever to actually come up with something. And I've come to the conclusion that it's easier to actually sit down and do it manually, the way we always did it, rather than, you know, having the machine do it.
But it's going to get better, right? Like, the technology is going to get better. And that's where there needs to be a line drawn in the sand, I think, where I think the labels are right to resist and push back. They have to. I think as the things progress, we will see more and more music coming into the ecosystem. And I think there's a lot of work going into detection of AI-generated music. And I think it's important that the streaming platforms resist, if they can, having any of that music on their platforms. If they can detect it, it should be taken down, just like they take down fraudulent streaming and detect fraudulent streaming and often remove that music. So it should be treated in the same line, in my opinion. I think when I look through the licensing lens, our customers are largely enterprise customers, and they pride themselves in doing the right thing when it comes to the production process. And that is being ethical in terms of, you know, ensuring that a composer or the music's been properly licensed. And I don't believe Fortune 500 companies are looking for ways to skip over spending music on a production and risking being the product of
really, the scorn they would get.
I don't think they're going to do that, and we've certainly seen no signs of that in our business. But time changes a lot of things, and I think the industry has to remain very, very, very active. I think also, like, people want to be connected to the artists. Well, one thing I've learned just personally from Bandcamp is just how passionate the fan base is, and how much they're willing to support the artists that they follow. And that there's more to music than just the music itself. It's the artist's life, their essence, what they've gone through, their journey in life, and how that is amplified through their music and through their performance and their product, generally speaking. And I think that I don't think we're going to lose that overnight.
If you're tired of your mixes coming out muddy, thin, or lifeless, I have great news. You can take the quality of your mixes from amateur to pro level using the techniques of the world's top mixers. I'll show you these quick solutions to 15 common mix problems with my Mix Fix playbook. Go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. Paul, let's go there for a second. After you purchased Bandcamp, I'm sure you got your hands dirty in it, and I'm wondering what surprised you about Bandcamp that maybe you didn't know before.
Well, there's some really great metrics on Bandcamp. That's quite staggering metrics, I think. There's and I'll talk very sort of broadly in terms of these metrics, so I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but there's approximately 75,000 transactions a day. And that in itself is an incredible achievement. There is circa around $50 million in vinyl sold a year on the platform. And I think the vinyl market, I think last year was 2023, was about $1.3 billion. Yeah. So Bandcamp represents 3% to 4% of the entire vinyl market, which, again, is another amazing stat. There is a remarkable amount of digital downloads. So I think,
wow, that's surprising.
Close to $100 million goes through the system a year just on digital downloads. So it's, and this is, you know, it's really a testament to the support that fans, you know, show their artists, but they also like that medium. They enjoy using the product, and I think there's a lot more to be discovered. You know, I'm still very much learning about the audience, the product, and you know, we've been careful not to just assume things need to change just because, you know, we see things a certain way. It's very much a learning process for us to get to know the product and like, where can we add value? How can we unlock more opportunity? How can we create more revenue or revenue opportunities? And licensing is obviously a key one that we're working on. But you know, I feel like Bandcamp is, especially in an age where there is, you know, there is real dissatisfaction to how much an independent artist can earn on a streaming platform. And we're really interested in how we can provide more value for them, and whether, you know, whether that's future, you know, models that allow for, you know, more equitable streaming, we'll see where we go. But that's, you know, we're open-minded at this stage as far as, you know, what is possible and where we can potentially take them.
Let's go back to something that you mentioned right in the beginning when we began to talk. And that's about when a song has multiple songwriters, and, you know, we've seen this happen where, especially on some hip hop songs, there might be 20 songwriters on it. Yeah. And as a result, 20 publishers. I've spoken to many publishers and people that generally license music supervisors who will definitely want to stay away from that because the chances of clearing it are pretty low. Have you found a way to get around that?
Well, I mean, there are always the outliers where you have, you know, multiple writers, and that does cause problems, but it hasn't necessarily stopped us from executing a license. Often it's governed by the incoming demand. So if we're working with a brand or an agency that creative direction has taken it towards a particular song, and that's really the song that I want, then we will be there to execute that license. Now, sometimes that takes some working, right? Sometimes there's some hunting down the missing 1% writer to get their sign off. We've got some really, really great people here in America, in London, and all over the world. Usually we can solve it. And generally speaking, we're talking high value licenses that are, to do this every day for a $500 license, it's not really scalable. That this is very much the sort of push model where our customers push into us what they want, and then we go and get it. Where a different model we have is also where rights holders provide us with their music and we connect the rights together, and then they're able to be licensed without having that friction. But it's generally just one of those problems you have to solve. It's part of the music supervisor journey. We employ a lot of music supervisors that do that work.
Music supervisor, it's an interesting job, and not everybody can do it. I'm just wondering if the interface with a music supervisor, or music supervisors in general, is any different than anybody else that you deal with in the music industry.
So the question was, is the just cut out?
Yeah. When you're dealing with the music supervisor, is there wants and needs, I'm sure there are, that are different than anybody else in the music industry? Do you find it, you know, easier or harder to deal with? And because their needs are different.
We're often dealing with music supervisors that work for us, right? So
we
have our own music supervisor team that's working with brands and agencies. So no problems dealing with those. When we're working with external music supervisors that might be in film or TV, it's less our space. We've really focused on advertising, brands, games, apps, platforms for the digital space. And you know, a lot of music supervision in its traditional form is in the film and TV space. No, I think we've got some really great relationships with, you know, they're creative people. They're very passionate about what they do. Music supervisors are very much judged by the work that they produce, and we just do our best to support them wherever we can.
I think the music supervisors in general, their ambition has kind of changed over the years from the standpoint that they're almost operating like an A&R person. And if they can find something that's new that maybe people haven't heard of that they'll accept and they'll like, then they feel like it's a really big victory. I think that's great for artists, because rather than relying on the same stuff that we've heard, you know, forever, it's something new that we're going to hear.
As I was watching the other day, it's really interesting music on it. It'll probably reveal my four Netflix habits, but I think it was called The Perfect Couple. There's some really great music on there. It was a Netflix series that I binged on a weekend, and there were really interesting music choices. Like, and yeah, hats off to the music supervisor of that one, because it was a really good choices. And we have one of the acquisitions we made a number of years ago was TuneFind.com. Are you familiar with TuneFind?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's very much the sort of music supervisor database where many of them report to TuneFind, you know, what, and it's very much community based as well. The community also tracks their activity, but it tracks all of the activity of the music supervisors' choices in TV and film. And now I think we've expanded into gaming as well as advertising. So it becomes this sort of database of work. The reason why we bought that was we thought it's very interesting to know, to be able to track at scale, the data related to music supervisor choice. And, you know, to think about the relationship between the content that they've been working on and that music choice. And that has the potential to really power matching algorithms and search algorithms where music is being sourced for a particular project. So there's more work for us to do on that. Another business we bought a couple of years ago was an AI company called Music Cube. And Music Cube's, you know, role within our company, we integrated it into our technology stack, was very much around sort of understanding music from a metadata perspective, so that it can power more intuitive searches, so that music supervisors, so that, you know, industry could unlock, you know, what is the perfect track. I mean, I would say most of the time, even, you know, sync teams at labels are limited to some degree by their knowledge of the catalog when they get an incoming brief and they want to match a piece of music to that brief. And to leverage technology properly, ultimately you want to be able to uncover the best track you have in your catalog. And there's so much subjectivity in terms of interpreting a brief and the words associated with the brief. We've actually done a lot of work on just that, like entering words of a brief and then spitting out a search result. So that's kind of an area that we've invested a lot into, and we've got more work to do. But you know, interpreting an incoming brief and the needs of that brief, perhaps even understanding the music supervisor's prior choices, could help influence the choice of music that you uncover from your selection. But you need you know, technology to do that. You can't possibly know your entire catalog, especially if you're, you know, Universal or Sony. It's way too much to know.
But one of the problems there is the fact that, yes, it's great to be able to search for metadata and match it all together, but somebody has to insert that metadata to begin with. And I know songwriters, their eyes kind of glaze over. You know, it's a special job that not everybody can do, because they can't imagine what, oh, is this a happy song? Gee, I thought it was kind of sad. You know, it's one of those things.
Well, that's what our AI does, though. So our AI can actually read an audio file and generate thousands of data points that describe the audio file, so all the music. And so it, it, it works at scale. So you don't have to have, you know, someone, you don't want that because it's so subjective and there's so many elements. If you had one person, well, five different people interpreting music and entering metadata, you're going to get five different outcomes. And then fatigue will play a role in their choices. And then, you know, they might be rushing out the door and they've got a commitment to do 100 meta tags before they go to lunch. And then suddenly the last 10 of those are done poorly because you cannot rely on on humans to create metadata for such things. And that's why, you know, that's why we made that investment into this business, because it really has cracked the code on how to interpret that, how to interpret an audio file. And that we're continually developing this and creating, you know, new data points, but it really is about looking at an audio file, understanding everything from its mood to its characteristics to its predictable audience and the predictable demographics that sections of the music can also play out. You might find a chorus of one particular song is ideal for a particular ad campaign that's trying to reach, you know, 19 to 23 year old females on the east coast of the United States, and the rest of the song is irrelevant, right? And unpacking that and finding that and locating that is a kind of magic in that. So that's what, you know, we get quite excited about AI in this realm, because it's unlocking the value of music, it's improving discovery of music, and it can be rolled out across consumer interfaces as well. It doesn't just have to be B2B for commercial use. It can improve discovery so that your listening can be much more intuitive, so that, you know, you're starting to hear things that you never thought you would normally gravitate to, or a typical, you know, playlist would engineer for you. So it's, you know, I think there's so much music out there. I mean, we live in times where an unprecedented amount of music is made every day. And so I think discovery of music is really key to, you know, creating not only an equitable music industry, but also one that keeps us, you know, really entertained as listeners.
I think that's very cool. And just the fact that it will generate that for you, because again, humans can't do it well. It's so subjective.
Yeah, so, that's right.
All right, Paul, last question. How has music licensing changed? And do you see it changing in the future?
As businesses grow, you know, we've got two of the majors are public companies now, and efficiency is absolutely crucial to growing businesses. And as the industry continues to grow, more and more efficiency is required. You've got multiple forces. You've got more and more use of music. There's, you know, more platforms that use music at scale, whether it's, you know, today when you think of TikTok and YouTube and Facebook and Instagram and, you know, Spotify, Apple has been the kind of the big ones. The gaming world is exploding and more activities happening there. So there's going to be more and more demand for music, more and more use cases, and more demand for scale of music. And there's more and more music supply. And so finding the path to not fully automate, but near automate everything is important to the industry. And everyone's a beneficiary. Now, it's important for rights holders to have controls over their music, to be able to know where their music goes and where it doesn't, so that they, you know, they don't want necessarily their music used in an environment that's not true to their core values. That every artist is different, and labels also need to control value, and artists equally need to control the value that is attributed to their music. So, but what can't be tech enabled would be the question I'd ask. And so many manual processes still exist in the industry today that are time consuming, expensive, inefficient, inaccurate. And I see a world that, you know, perhaps it's 5 years away, perhaps it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years away, because it really does depend on adoption and the open-mindedness of the industry as a whole to adopt technologies that make their life easier, that make things far more efficient, far more fast and scalable, so that everyday activities that historically have been manual can be turned into tech-enabled and near automated solutions, so that perhaps the only decision that needs to be made is the permission to say yes and a value alignment. Now, many would say that's all we do, but when we think about all of the paperwork and we think about all of the negotiation and all the back and forth, and there's reasons for that. But even that can be tech-enabled. A negotiation can be tech-enabled. Happens all the time in when we think about bidding for things in different environments where we, I shop on Reverb.com. I have a terrible synthesizer addiction where I like to, you got guitars on your walls. I've got synthesizers downstairs, but I'm very passionate about that. And I'm constantly bidding for products that require the permission at the other end. I mean, that's a simplistic analogy, but it's a tech-enabled process.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Gear acquisition syndrome, as they would call it.
Yeah, I know. It's problematic. My wife is, it's like another synthesizer appears at the door. I found a hack. I only buy modules now.
Oh,
so I buy rack. I only buy it. So it's a great workaround. There's no more keys anywhere. It's okay, but now I'm getting this whole range of modules.
It's going to get bigger, Paul. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.